I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome to my show. On last week's underreported feature, we examined the regime and cult and personality surrounding Turkmenistan's president, Turkmenbashi. This week, we continue our look into the political and social issues of Central Asia with Uzbekistan. It made headline news recently when it closed a U.S. military base, but recent actions suggest that that was just part of a trend toward a more complete isolationism. Cassandra Cavanaugh from the Central Eurasia Project of the Open Society Institute joins me now. I'm very pleased to welcome you back to the show.
Thank you.
Within the past two weeks, Uzbekistan forced two NGOs to suspend activities, Internews and IREX, the International Research and Exchanges Board, two in just 4 days. On what grounds?
Uzbekistan is very irritated with the United States for a relatively principled response to the Andijan massacre on May 13th, when Uzbekistan's security forces gunned down maybe 1,000, maybe even more of its own citizens who were peacefully demonstrating on a square in an eastern city. And since then, President Karimov, who was the ex-communist leader before Uzbekistan was forced to become independent, has taken it into his head that the U.S. and U.S. NGOs are out to get him. This is something he began to feel after the Rose Revolution in Georgia and with events in Ukraine and then Kyrgyzstan. That sensation has become even more severe, and he's mightily suspicious of anyone who comes around talking about freedom or democracy or civil rights or things like that.
Well, Open Society Institute, the organization you work for, closed its office in Uzbekistan last year.
We were thrown out on the early wave, yes, the first one. Have that honor.
And are they all being forced out, or are some also leaving voluntarily?
Up till now, all the U.S.-based NGOs have been forced out, some on trumped-up court charges. You know, they have a draconian system of registration for any organization that wants to work there, so it's easy for the government to find a pretext.
But aren't NGOs doing the kind of work that most governments appreciate? They don't have to pay for all sorts of services being performed for their people.
This would be true. I guess you can differentiate between two kinds of NGOs, NGOs that are more focused on governmental reform and those that are focused on doing humanitarian type assistance. From what I understand right now, the government of Uzbekistan is still pretty patient towards NGOs that are doing bringing medical supplies and doing humanitarian projects of that nature. But anyone talking about changing the system, giving people more rights, they're not welcome anymore.
When were you in Uzbekistan last?
Well, last I was there last year in 2004. I went on business shortly before the Open Society Institute was closed down. Since our closure, the Open Society Institute still continues to support projects there in the country, particularly in the field of human rights.
And what was the political climate like when you visited? Were you able to speak to people freely?
Well, very, very tense. And it's never clear that people can speak absolutely freely. I prefer to talk to our partners when they come out of the country. It's much easier now then. But now, from what I understand from people who've been there just last week, the security services are really permeating all avenues of interchange. And any foreigner who goes there now is very closely followed. So it's you can get people in a lot of trouble that way.
And it sounds to me like it's getting worse. What was it like when Uzbekistan first got its independence?
Well, you know, something I can comment about that because I have been going there since I was a student in the mid-1980s. And IREX, the organization that was shut down this week, I actually helped open the office in 1994, 1995. And Uzbekistan had a completely different attitude towards the United States and Western assistance in general. There was, although it was still quite an authoritarian country, there was at least a dialogue about some kind of gradual change. And people were extremely welcoming towards all kinds of contacts with the West.
And what changed that?
My personal belief is it's the president's own paranoia and his view that he's got to keep hold on what he has and what his family has been able to accumulate and through this very kind of personalized rule. If you can make a comparison with Turkmenbashi, there's not quite the open bizarre cult of personality that there is in neighboring Turkmenistan, but still, it's very much a country that's built on authoritarian style of rule.
Well, almost all of those Central Asian countries made the transition with former communist leaders who then describe their politics as being changed. Is
Absolutely.
That what happened here as well?
Well, yes, and the transition that everyone was very hopeful about, they talked about a transition to democracy, but what was actually completed was this transition to authoritarianism. The party was moved aside, and these men took over party structures and substituted their own rule in its place, with varying degrees of success. While Kazakhstan, to the north, maintains a very strong system of personal rule by the president, there has been some degree of economic reform. The tragedy for Uzbekistan is that this authoritarianism hasn't been accompanied by any kind of increase in the standard of living for its people. Just quite the opposite. People are descending into further degrees of poverty and immiseration.
Despite the fact that there are lots of valuable natural resources in the country.
Uzbekistan is the world's second largest exporter of cotton. It also exports gold, actually, that it helps to mine with the help of a U.S.-based multinational, Newmont Mining Corporation. And it also has some reserves of natural gas, a little bit of oil. But it's a very, very wealthy, potentially wealthy country, mostly based on its agriculture. So that's even a greater tragedy.
And this is just going into the pockets of the president and his close friends?
And his cronies. We have reason to believe, particularly with the export of cotton, that's highly dominated by the state and people around him. So that's a great source of their illegitimate wealth.
Since oil and natural gas are also regional matters and pipelines are regional, what have President Karimov's relations with his neighbors been like?
Well, Uzbekistan is not, they have much less oil and gas. They're really kind of a minor player, especially in comparison to Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan to the north. But relations with their neighboring states are a very sensitive point. Uzbekistan is highly dependent on Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, the upland states closer to the mountain ranges, for the water that it uses for its agriculture. At the same time, Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan to the east and south are dependent on Uzbekistan for gas. So just to give you an example, this is a constant source of strife. Just to give you an example, when Kyrgyzstan recently took in about 500 refugees that fled across the Uzbek border after the Andijan massacre, Uzbekistan announced that it was shutting off the gas. But of course, Kyrgyzstan has a certain amount of leverage. If it decides to use all of its water in the winter to produce hydroelectric power, there won't be any left to irrigate the Uzbek fields in the summer. It's a very delicate web of interrelations that have to be managed quite carefully.
So let's talk about that massacre. It occurred last May when protests were held in the eastern town of Andijan. How far away is Andijan from Tashkent, the capital?
It's about 5 hours by car. You have to go over a mountain range, a pass that's very difficult to get past in the winter. But it's not terribly far. But in a sense, Andijan is the heart of this Fergana Valley region, the valley that cuts across the three states, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. It's a very different world, of course. In pre-Soviet times, it was part of the Kokand Khanate, entirely different national system than it was only incorporated later into the Russian Empire. So Fergana has its own culture. It's very densely populated, and probably the people there are more Islamically observant than they are in the rest of the country.
Are they all Uzbeki, whatever that means?
It's very, very interesting. I mean, Uzbek itself is kind of a synthesized nationality. The borders of what is now Uzbekistan were only set by the Soviet Union in 1924 to break up these pre-Russian Kokand Khanate, Bukharan Khanate, and Hivan Khanate. So it's in a sense, it's an invented nationality, but one that, as all nationalities are, as Benedict Anderson tells us, but one that's been very successfully invented.
Mm-hmm. In fact, we talked last week about nationalism being a driving force in Turkmenistan. Is the same the case here?
There is the sense that if you are a citizen of Uzbekistan, it is highly desirable to be Uzbek, and that's particularly relevant for people who live in the other, so the southwestern end of the country, in the cities of Samarkand and Bukhara, that are historically part of the Bukharan Khanate and are mostly Farsi, Tajik-speaking. But a lot of the people there from the 1920s have felt a good deal of pressure to reinvent themselves as Uzbeks. So that's a factor.
Bukharans in New York are mostly Jews, and they tell me that even though this is ostensibly a secular country, they were told that it was in their best interest to leave after independence was achieved in 1991.
Mm-hmm. That's a sad story because those were millennium-old Jewish communities that are now essentially being relocated to the United States and to Israel. Yeah.
On the other hand, the massacre resulted from another kind of religious protest, didn't it?
It's something that the Uzbek government wants outsiders to believe, that these were Islamic extremists rising up to overthrow the government. That's the government line. When in fact, what happened is that Uzbekistan, at least since 1998, has had this policy of labeling any and all potential enemies as Islamists and throwing them in jail. Early in the year 2005, or maybe in late 2004, they arrested in Andijan a group of 23 successful businessmen who had been involved in local charity, trying to alleviate some of the terrible poverty around them, and labeled these people as enemies of the state. And protests began almost immediately for people in the community who had been hired by these businessmen. They came out and protested these trials as unjust. What happened on May 13th is that a group of these protesters, after they had heard the verdict, and these all the 23 were sentenced to very long terms after they'd been tortured and otherwise abused, came out and they organized a jailbreak, got the 23 out, emptied the local prison, and then came out, took over the mayoralty of Andijan City, and huge numbers of people, quite spontaneously from what we know from eyewitnesses, as is documented in Human Rights Watch's excellent report on Andijan, so any of your listeners should check that out, they came out onto the streets spontaneously and the whole day were demonstrating there, speaking for the first time in many years freely about their terrible social and economic situation. And then the government surrounded the city with tanks and essentially fired into these thousands of demonstrators, killing many.
The estimates range from 180 to 700. That's quite a range.
And even higher. I spoke to eyewitnesses who interviewed police sources in Uzbekistan who wanted to remain anonymous, who said as many potentially as 4,000 people were killed.
And does the government just simply say that this was a result of Islamic fundamentalism?
They say it was fundamentalists. They say it was a terrorist attack organized from across the border in Kyrgyzstan. And from what I understand, some of the people they're attempting to arrest, they've even labeled them as American spies. So it's this highly paranoid 1930s-style scenario they've developed.
They didn't go to the United States the way that Russia has and say, well, these people are just Islamic fundamentalists, terrorists. That's what Russia does with Chechnya.
They tried to ply that line with all their international partners, but thankfully the United States isn't buying it.
Okay. I'm talking with Cassandra Cavanaugh about the situation in Uzbekistan, where the president is ironically named Islam Karimov. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break here on WNYC. Stay with us. We're back with Cassandra Cavanaugh from the Central Eurasia Project of the Open Society Institute. We're talking about Uzbekistan and the rule of its president, Islam Karimov. What does this country look like? Photographs that I've seen make it very dramatic.
It's about the size of California, and a lot of the landscape looks like the San Joaquin Valley. But of course, there's a large expanse of desert up by the Aral Sea in the north and west, Karakal, Pakistan. But it's really the heart of Central Asia, between these two river valleys, the Oxus and the Jakartes, the Amu and the Sir Darya, incredibly important for Islamic history, and the pivot of power in this region, 26 million people and growing, bordering Afghanistan. It's dry but incredibly fertile, and a beautiful place.
Were you surprised when the Bush White House criticized Uzbekistan for what happened after the in Andijan, because it had seen Uzbekistan as a real ally, a major resource for its fight in Afghanistan and its hopes of catching Osama bin Laden.
I was relieved when they criticized them because there's long been this bifurcation in U.S. policy since September 11th. We've tried to make Uzbekistan our partner in the war on terrorism because of its location bordering Afghanistan. That's why we asked them the permission to put the military base there to supply Operation Enduring Freedom. So we have this security partnership with them on the one hand, and a very sinister security partnership, I must say, because it's recently come to light that Uzbekistan is probably the destination for some of the prisoners that the U.S. has rendered to third countries in its so-called war on terrorism. But on the other hand, we've had there's been a strong component of U.S. policy in supplying all kinds of aid for democratization, supporting these NGOs that we're talking about, and criticizing Uzbekistan fairly forthrightly in its annual State Department reports on human rights. So in this case, the human rights side won out over the defense imperative side.
A woman just called in from Turkmenistan, and she said that anytime anything went wrong, it would be blamed by the government on capitalism. She was wondering what Uzbekistan's position on capitalism is. Do they consider themselves capitalists? Is there any kind of a free market society?
That's a really interesting question. Economic reforms in Uzbekistan have been very limited. They had proceeded more robustly up to about 1996, when the president realized that currency conversion would mean that a lot of his cronies making money on these currency trades would lose money. And that was put off. Just last year, or actually late in 2003, they made the currency convertible again. You can say there is a kind of capitalism there, but it's crony capitalism. All the major resources and exports are controlled by people close to the president, and it's incredibly difficult for small business people to get businesses started.
On the other hand, people who visited the area during the Soviet era told me that people ate better in places like Tashkent than they did in Moscow because small farmers were allowed to sell their own produce.
That's right, and that's what's so shocking and tragic about the current state of Uzbekistan, especially rural Uzbekistan, that there's, if anything, there's more control over people, their basic economic activity in the countryside than there was in Soviet times. It's true, people are poorer than they were in Soviet times, and if you go there, you'll hear people bemoaning that all the time.
President Karimov has claimed that he's fighting an information war. What do you think he means by that?
Well, it's funny, I've been reading a discussion over the internet by people in Uzbekistan of the Uzbek government is pursuing this propaganda campaign, trying to suppress all knowledge of the Andijan massacre. It's basically, as one person on this website, Fergana Rue, said today, they're trying to turn the truth inside out. The government is complaining that all of this reportage about Andijan is an information war conducted by whom, it's not clear, against the Uzbek government. It's a Cold War mentality run amok.
Did he feel that the NGOs were spreading rumors?
Absolutely, and that's part of the reason why there's such enormous suspicion and why in this period since Andijan, there's been an even greater effort by the government to control not just international NGOs, but local NGOs that also had flourished in this brief period since the early 90s, and now the government is reasserting control over most of them.
Despite authoritarian rule in Kyrgyzstan and Ukraine, major opposition movements developed. Is that possible here?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know that I would ascribe conditions in Kyrgyzstan to major opposition movements. If anything, the opposition was quite surprised there that Akayev fell as quickly as he did.
And then they were crushed ultimately as well, weren't they?
Well, they weren't crushed. I mean, they came to power simply because there was a vacuum. Akayev fled. There was no one to take over. Since then, they've had fairly successful elections in July, and they're muddling through trying to decide which direction to send the country in.
And we see Ukraine in serious turmoil
right now. In serious turmoil, right, with their opposition and government at odds, or the government now split against itself. The opposition in Uzbekistan has... there was a secular opposition up until about 1994. They were forced out of the country by the president. And within the country, they maintain some connections and some movements, but they're very, very weak, at least But that's not to say that there's not a great amount of opposition sentiment. People are incredibly unhappy with this government because they see the state to which it's brought them.
Well, how can they express that except in the way that we saw in Andijan, one instance?
That's another tragic feature of this, is that most people were out there on the square simply trying to express their grievances and trying to get answers from the government. A lot of people we read about in these Human Rights Watch reports came out wearing their best clothes because they expected the president to come and speak to them in this kind of age-old tradition of ruler meeting his governed. So there's, after Andijan, I think prospects for more popular uprisings and discontent are a little bit less than they were.
We mentioned earlier that Internews was forced to shut down. What were they doing?
Internews was doing wonderful work helping local journalists and local television stations to get content not controlled by the government, helping to train journalists, producers, TV and radio broadcasters to get real news from their communities and rebroadcast it. So very subversive if you're bent on running a totalitarian state.
So how much access do the people of Uzbekistan have to news about what's going on even outside of their country?
The funny thing about being in Uzbekistan is that you're always the least informed about what's going on around you. You can watch the BBC World, you know, if you have a satellite dish, if you know English, and learn about what's going on in the outside world. But Uzbekistan has asked BBC broadcasters, news journalists within the country, to leave. The only access to real news about your own country is through shortwave radio, and that's very limited access.
But would they know what happened in Kyrgyzstan or what happened in the Ukraine?
Rumor. And the internet are the major sources of real news about that, and both are very easily distorted. And the government is very sensitive to that. It blocks a lot of internet news sites and tries to arrest people for, downloading information.
My guest is Cassandra Cavanaugh from the Central Eurasia Project of the Open Society Institute. This is the Leonard LoPate Show on WNYC 93.9. We're online at WNYC.org. You can also download us on podcasts. And right now, at the same time, on AMA 20, you can hear gavel-to-gavel coverage of the John Roberts confirmation hearings. I was wondering about what you said about the massacre, that people expected something quite different. It almost sounds to me like what happened in Tiananmen Square, where people expected a traditional kind of engagement from the government and instead wound up being shot upon.
Many people have called it Uzbekistan's Tiananmen, and the shocking and appalling thing is that, at least in the wake of Tiananmen, as other people have written, China was in the diplomatic deep freeze for a while, when Uzbekistan has really endured no consequences diplomatically. I mean, the European Union, they're planning a parliamentary session there in Tashkent on the 3rd of October. The subject was supposed to come up in a recent foreign ministers' EU meeting, but it didn't.
And why do you think that is?
The
cotton that valuable?
As a matter of fact, I think the EU has this position that trade and engagement are always the right stance to take. And there's a real difference between the U.S. There. When in fact, we and others of our partners are trying to inspire people to think about sanctions, because there has to be some way of influencing this government before it runs its own people into the ground, a la Zimbabwe.
That has been an argument we've heard a lot about China, for example, that the more trade that we do with China, the more open the society will be, just as a consequence. There seems to be a certain amount of truth to that. At the same time, the Chinese government has been quite successful in keeping it as slow a transition as possible. A small country like Uzbekistan, I assume, would be a lot easier to keep under control.
You would think that there would be greater levers that could be used to influence the government. And there is some discussion within U.S. government circles and in Congress about targeted sanctions, travel bans, finding the source of foreign assets held abroad by members of government. But it's not going as fast as it should be.
How significant is the issue of Islamic fundamentalism in the country? I know there were some bombings in 2004.
It's a traditional Muslim country. For the Soviet period of its history, the Islamic culture has been interrupted. So there's been a disjuncture there. But Islam is the source of people's community organization, is the source of their ethics and morality. So people are always going to return to Islam to find answers and to find comfort and solace for all the injustices around them. I would say that fundamentalism is not something that comes naturally. I mean, to Uzbeks, they're part of the Hanafi school of Islam. You know, the Salafists, there was a certain number of Saudi Salafi preachers there in the early and mid-1990s, but those are mostly gone. And it's definitely, the threat is made much greater by the government than it actually is in reality.
Haven't all of the former Soviet republics tried to remain relatively secular since they gained independence?
Mm-hmm.
And has that been a source of tension?
Militantly secular. And as a matter of fact, what they've done is they've maintained the Soviet system of bureaucratic control over religion. And it is very much a source of tension because people believe that after independence there was going to be an Islamic revival. What they found is the same sort of imams and preachers controlled by the government, and people mistrust them.
Do you think that Karimov's actions have added fuel to the fire by overstating a threat? Perhaps he winds up sowing seeds
Absolutely.
Of discontent?
And not only by overstating the threat, but by arresting thousands and thousands of people, young men and even young women alike, and throwing them in jail, torturing them, torturing their families, and saying, you are Islamic fundamentalists, you are enemies of the state. He's like the title of Human Rights Watch's report from last year, he's creating enemies of the state.
Well, we've seen this in other places because the Catholic Church sided with Solidarity. People who might not have even been religious then threw themselves in with that movement mm-hmm. because they were in opposition to the state. Do you think the same thing is happening here?
If it seems like the only source of some social justice somewhere down the line, I think absolutely that's the case here.
So how much impact do you think the Andijan massacre will actually have? Is it a turning point, or is it just one of the many manifestations of a growing crisis?
I think it's a turning point, but one that's probably not going to bear fruit for in the short or even medium term, unless something happens to Karimov and there's a palace coup or he dies. But it's definitely something that's planted enormous discontent in the popular mind. And, you know, it means this government has basically sealed off its chances of a real rapprochement with its own people.
At the same time, you say that it's been pretty much ignored on the international level. Do you think it even came up or will come up during this UN summit?
Well, Karimov is not here. I'm not sure. I don't even think his foreign minister is taking part. I'm not sure, but there is a movement to get Uzbekistan on the agenda of the Security Council, but I doubt it will come up at the summit.
I'm sure that the U.S. military base brought some economic benefits to Uzbekistan. So do you think it was a difficult decision to make to ask the United States to close it?
I think Karimov is calling the shots, and he often makes decisions like this in a fit of pique or anger, and I think the Russians are definitely prompting him to do this sort of thing. I frankly, as brutal as it sounds, I don't really think he cares much about the economic well-being of his people, particularly in this area of the country.
Do you think that the United States is concerned? Was that base considered a valuable one?
I know it is concerned, and I know there was a real struggle between the Department of Defense and even within the Department of Defense and the State Department as to what to do about the base, because this confrontation between the human rights end of U.S. policy and the defense and security end of U.S. policy has been apparent for a long time. It will be more difficult, I know, to supply operations in Afghanistan without the base, but they will do it. I was told by someone in the State Department that they decided not to hold back on criticism of Uzbekistan, even though they knew that it would cost them the base. And I guess I believe that.
There have been reports that Uzbekistan is headed for a serious crisis. Do you think that that's just an optimistic assessment by people outside?
Optimistic on one hand and very pessimistic on the other. I mean, Karimov reportedly is grooming Shavkat Mirziyoyev, a former governor of Samarkand, as some kind of successor. But I think definitely there will be a power struggle if he goes or if someone decides to make Karimov history. I don't see it in the near term, but in the medium term, depending on what happens to Karimov as an individual, I don't think secession will be an easy period. It could be quite bloody.
How old is he?
He's 68, almost 70. He's reported to have leukemia, but that's been reported for a long time. He's not gone anywhere yet.
Aren't the trials of people suspected in the May uprising coming up?
They are on September 20th, I believe they're going to begin. But these are the kinds of show trials that Uzbekistan has been organizing for at least the five years since its first major terrorist attack, bombings in February of 1999. So no one expects these trials to be at all legitimate.
But what about their impact on the public? Do you think that they're likely to cause further tension?
It's really hard to say. The state propaganda machine has been relentless in making films and having news programming, you know, berating these people as terrorists and extremists. And it's hard to know what people take away from that. Increasingly, I think there's a suspicion of the government propaganda machine. If they could spark more tension, I think the security apparatus is too strong to look for something.
Who's being tried?
People who were accused of being of having been demonstrators on that day. Demonstrators made into organizers. Could also be random people. It's not entirely clear. Never a problem to find enemies if you need to there.
Do you see any hope for this region?
I'd like to because Uzbek people are amazingly talented traders and artisans and artists, and there's such enormous rich human potential there that I try to remain hopeful.
And Tashkent is one of the most beautiful cities in the world, isn't it?
Tashkent is very beautiful. Samarkand is beautiful. The land is rich and you know, the people are talented.
I want to thank you so much for being with us again, Cassandra Cavanaugh from the Central Eurasia Project of the Open Society Institute. We've been talking about, in this case, Uzbekistan as part of a series we've been doing on Central Asia, on underreported, unfortunately, Central Asia too much overlooked by the world press, despite all of the terrible situation that is going on there. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you.